Welcome to The Rock Fight, where we speak our truth, slay sacred cows, and sometimes agree to disagree. This is an outdoor podcast that aims for the head. I'm Colin True, and today we're heading to the ocean, the river, the lake. We're checking in on paddling. Paddling used to be one of the outdoor sports the adventure community talked about the most. So what's happening on the water? Well, we're about to find out. But before we get to that, look, you love rock fighting. We love rock fighting. Let's all get on the same rock fighting team. Head to rockfight.co. Enjoy all the content we put up on our website. It's really good, folks. Check it out. And sign up for our mailing list. Give this podcast 5 stars on whatever app you're listening to it on. And man, we would love it if you left us a written review. Thanks for supporting your rock fighting home team. And all right, let's start the show. I want to start today by taking a second and thinking back to the activities that drew me outside. I was in my 20s before I really committed to a life of adventure. I had landed in New Hampshire because, well, I just wanted to live in New Hampshire. Pretty early on, I discovered the lure of the White Mountains, and for someone who grew up surrounded by Pennsylvania farmland, it was mind-blowing. So hiking, of course, was instrumental in showing me that this was more than just a hobby, but a full-on lifestyle that I had discovered. And that led to lots of firsts in the Granite State. It's the place where I tried rock climbing, snowboarding, ice climbing all for the first time. But living near the coast, sea kayaking is what really pulled me in. The 1990s was when things really started blowing up for outdoor adventure, and one of the cornerstones of the scene was boating. If you go dig around on YouTube, you'll find all sorts of videos from that time. Tutorials, MTV sports clips, whitewater kayaking, sea kayaking, all the same stuff you'll find if you go looking for rock climbing or mountain bike videos from the same era. And in 1999, I had started working at Eastern Mountain Sports' location in Peabody, Mass. The veteran staff in that shop were all paddlers, with some serving double duty between EMS and guiding for Essex River Basin Adventures, or ERBA, a local kayaking guide service. And on one late summer evening in early September of that same year, my wife and I took a tour with ERBA. And for the first time, we got in the sea kayaks and cut our paddling chops with a spin around the tidal basin of the Essex River, immediately falling in love with the activity. We saw wildlife, we learned the pleasure of gliding through the water, and near the end, I learned a valuable lesson as an errant paddle stroke led me to capsizing. The outdoors always has a way of teaching us. Also, it turns out that ERBA closed their doors in 2021, and anyone listening to this who spent any time in the New England paddling scene in the past 30 years definitely has an ERBA story or acquaintance. I'm definitely glad that ERBA played a small role in my personal adventure history. And after that first paddle, we got our own boats. And until we moved to the landlocked Intermountain West, kayaking was a featured item on our menu of outdoor fun. When we eventually found our way to the Pacific Northwest, we again sought out sea kayaks for paddling on Puget Sound. But then we got caught up in the boom of stand-up paddleboarding, eventually passing our unused sea kayaks over to some friends. So what am I getting at here? Well, given the heritage of paddle sports in the outdoor adventure scene, I don't hear about kayaking anymore, like, at all. Now, that may be because I live in surf-obsessed California, I'm not working at a Northeast coastal outdoor retailer, or I'm simply not surrounded by paddlers anymore. But it does seem that where most outdoor retailers used to carry a large share of boats, my experience, anecdotally, is that things have changed. Was it due to the boom of stand-up? Have these sports become less cool? Maybe we just hit a plateau and it all kind of stayed where it was and I just don't see it anymore like I used to? To find some answers on the state of one of the pillars that I built my personal adventure identity on, I connected with Joe Potocek, who is the digital editor of Paddling Magazine and a longtime paddler himself. Joe and I talked about the state of paddling, current paddling trends, and how paddling media has changed in the face of user-generated content, and why it is that I don't see as much about the category as I used to. Welcome back to The Rock Fight, where today we're talking all things paddling with Joe Potocek of Paddling Magazine. All right, well, we're here today with Joe Potocek. Did I say it right?
Yeah, absolutely. You got
Potocek. It. Potocek, all right. Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't hit the second O. Okay, we're here today with Joe Potocek. That's better. Joe is the digital editor at Paddling Magazine. And he's here today to help me kind of get reacquainted with a category that used to be a big part of my life. But before we get to that, Joe, welcome to the show, man. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Colin.
What's going on up in Oregon right now? What's the state of the paddling? What's the paddling weather looking like in Oregon? Are we still in dry suits? Like what would you go out with right now to go paddling in Oregon on April 9th, 2024?
Oh man, paddling wise, we're always in dry suits here in Oregon. There are rare opportunities to not be in a dry suit. But it's
the lakes still warm up, like even like freshwater stuff. It doesn't get warm. What do you can't get to?
Oh, some will. Big rivers like the Columbia and the Willamette. They'll definitely warm up in the summer. You can be out in board shorts and whatnot. But a lot of the rivers, you know, the ocean, Pacific up here.
Sure.
It's pretty cold.
Well, anecdotally speaking, you know, and I'm not coming into our conversation with hard numbers, like either by like media coverage or retail sales. This is totally from my purview, because when the adventure sports boom sort of started in the 1990s, I feel like paddling was a really important part of that. And some of that may have been where I was living in New England. I don't think it was, though. I feel like this was, it was part of the scene. I feel like the Mount Rushmore of sports kind of coming out of the era was probably climbing, snowboarding, mountain biking, and kayaking. And sea kayaking was a huge part of my entry into adventure sports. And it just doesn't seem like I hear about it as much anymore. Like, we were talking about it before we hit record. I'm not sure if that's, you know, big outdoor media, like, leaving it behind for whatever reason. If that's the stand-up paddleboard boom that just sort of, like, you know, decimated the playing field. But I really was kind of reflecting back on it, and I was reflecting on the fact that we don't talk about paddling much on the show, which is a crime because it's such an awesome category. So that's why you're here. So the, like, how would you today, as someone working at a paddling, you know, media company, how would you position the paddling category within the sort of larger world of outdoor adventure sports? Do I sound like a crazy person? Do you see some sort of truth in what I'm saying?
So yeah, definitely to a certain degree. I mean, I think in the 90s and early 2000s, there was a big push for a lot of these adventure sports. You know, you think about Subaru throwing logos on cars and
right.
kayaks on the roof.
In the launch of the Xterra.
Yeah, for sure. And the media, paddling has never had as strong of a foothold in the media as some of the other skiing, surfing, stuff like that. But there are somewhere between 30 and 40 million people in the U.S. going paddling. So tons of people out there going paddling. It's right behind the big ones like camping, hiking, running. It's behind those. It's not as big. But there are actually a ton of people interacting with paddle sports. I think a big thing we have to reframe or look at is how we define what paddling is and what it isn't. I think what it isn't is a great place to start, especially in whitewater kayaking. I came from a whitewater kayaking background, and we always wanted to be the cool, you know, surfer lifestyle thing. And I'm sorry, but it is just not. We wear tons of like these clothes, like we were talking about dry suits before. We look super awkward while we're learning it. And we're out in these middle of nowhere environments, so it just doesn't have that lifestyle appeal in whitewater. We try to make it look sexy like surfing. I think the only people who have ever made it look sexy are Burt Reynolds and Meryl Streep. But other than that, yeah, whitewater is a very niche-like category. But with that said, there are a ton of people going kayaking in recreational kayaks, in canoes. So people are going kayaking. We just need to be open to the fact of who is going kayaking and how they're interacting with the sport.
You got to caught my attention with the whitewater comment, because Halsman, who's my co-host on a lot of episodes, has mentioned that in the past, that he kind of felt like there was a dorky element to whitewater. I've never seen whitewater kayaking as anything other than incredibly badass, partly due to the kit. I think, like, you see a paddler with the dry suit on, with the dry top on, with the PFD on, with the helmet on. I'm like, that looks sick. That person's going out to, like, do something really cool today. So what is the self-perception about it's kind of a dorky thing? And or, you know, is that just you being, like, you know, humble and self-deprecating? Or is that kind of a common, like, commonly held view?
I think running rivers, like running hard rapids, is an incredible thing to watch. I think the dorky factor comes in when we kind of have to explain the joke. When we're doing, like, you know, when we're doing these little maneuvers and stuff like that, and we have to, like, tell people, you know, what we are up to or what's going on, and then it's like, okay, so, you know, when you watch a sport like surfing or skiing and somebody goes off of a ramp skiing or hucks a cliff, like, you don't have to explain that. So the river running aspect of kayaking, being in that kit, being out in that cold water, like the energy of paddling a river, that stuff you don't have to explain. That is extremely cool. But it's also not very accessible. I was watching Patty O'Connell's Outside episode. On, you know, learning how to whitewater kayak, and you see even just to get down a class 2-3 rapid, how difficult it is. Like, you got to learn how to roll. Like, you're in this contraption that's basically trying to drown you when you flip over. So it's a difficult thing for a lot of people to access, but people want to be on the water. So they find a way to do that.
Yeah, I guess you're right too. And as you're talking, I'm kind of picturing kind of the typical like silhouette of like all the, like, you know, what's cleaner than a surfer in a wetsuit. And then even if you take it to a skier, like just the kit that you're wearing kind of smooths everything out, right? You kind of like it, usually the, you know, the kit looks good on a skier. I mean, like, there is a lot of kind of interesting angles maybe to the way a whitewater kayaker is dressed. And if you don't know and you kind of took a look at it, I could see how that kind of perception would maybe get passed around a little bit.
I'll never forget walking into like a pizza shop in my paddling gear and people looking at me like I just like jumped out of an airplane and landed there, you know, because you've got your helmet on and your skirt like flapping around your waist and people always ask what that thing is. So
they're like, is there a military base around here? What's going on?
Yeah, exactly.
But back to kind of what you said, though, about the kind of participation numbers, did the sit-on-top kayak kind of kill, like, the sea kayaking boom? Because I just immediately think of paddling, I think, you know, 17-foot sea kayak. But then, obviously, which is not a bad thing, by the way, to have, like, sit-on-top kayaks. Way more easier entryways into a sport is a good thing. But is this sort of, did that kind of proliferation of, like, the more recreation-level kayak kind of almost displace some of what was happening in paddling, or at least overshadow?
The sit-on-top was huge. That's a great thing to mention. The category we're talking about, it's the term recreational kayak, right? And that includes both sit-on-tops and even like sit-inside kayaks, as the ones that we see in like sporting goods stores, like Dick's Sporting Goods, like, you know, chain right. stores. We call those recreational kayaks. I would say they had a huge impact, but probably not in the negative way that you would think. Going back to talking about whitewater and sea kayaking, those are two like niche categories that have kind of a hard learning curve and not a lot of people want to go through the effort of. When we talk about recreational kayaking, you know, sit-on-top kayaks, when we talk about stand-up paddle boards, people just want to get out on the water, right? So they'll like pull out of the car, go out for a few miles, come back to the car. Like it's less intensive to get into. So what if you paddle around in circles on the lake while you're figuring it out, or you just float down a slow moving river, like the closest river to your town? So I actually think that the reason, if we look at those like 30, 40 million people going paddling, those are mostly people in canoes and recreational kayaks. Whitewater kayaks and sea kayaks, they're all the way down here. So I think we have an odd way in the paddling industry of looking at like who is a paddler. Like if I describe myself a whitewater kayaker or a sea kayaker, like yourself, you had mentioned, you kind of say like, man, why is nobody going paddling anymore? But what you're really saying is why doesn't anybody do what I do anymore? And
right.
you know, we're, that's yeah, a good point. People are figuring out ways to recreate and they don't always want it to be a whole ordeal. You know, it would be like, I'm trying to think of an example in another sport. Like if you were skateboarding and you were like a freestyle skateboarder, you know, hitting half pipes and whatnot, if you see that everybody's out on longboards cruising around on town and whatnot, you wouldn't say like, why is nobody skateboarding anymore? Like, why is nobody right. at a skate park? Or why is Alpine tourism? Why is nobody going skiing anymore when the resorts are full? So it's just reframing the idea of like what paddling is. And I mean, tons of people are going paddling.
You're just opening my eyes because, like, I'm the one who's kind of lobbying for so long to be like, look, the hardcore outdoors doesn't exist as much anymore. And the younger generation views anything as outside as outdoor. And I think I probably stopped. I mean, it's been a while since I've owned a sea kayak. You know, it's been a while since I was kind of an important part of what I've done. And I must be a little stunted in that part of my brain of like, that's what kayaking is. Versus and not really accepting probably how the entire category has evolved, like every other outdoor category has evolved, right? It's a really good point. Yeah, and it's a good, I mean, so the health of the sport overall, you feel better than ever? And like, obviously, a lot of participation numbers right behind camping, it's still, you feel like the paddling category as a category is doing pretty well?
Oh, yeah, it's doing great. Continues to evolve. And it's a gateway, right? It's a gateway sport. You're never going to pick up everybody to get into a whitewater kayak or a sea kayak, but you're still picking up people getting into it. The idea is to open the opportunity. Pelican, the kayaks, the outdoor that you see in all the shops, those recreational kayaks we talked about, they are now one of the largest manufacturers of kayaks in the world, and they're grabbing other companies. They've picked up a bunch of legacy brands like Dagger, like Wilderness Systems, like Perception. Those are all owned by Pelican now, so you can see that they see a value And okay, mm-hmm. we make all these recreational kayaks, and we see a value in having the next step for people, like the people who do want to get into a Dagger kayak or who do want to get into wilderness systems. So I think that big brands like that recognize that you create the gateway category that the most people can do, and then that opens opportunities for people to get into the next thing if they want to.
Well, and observationally, it does seem like, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but like, it seems like stand-up paddling kind of took over the category, at least in the middle, like 20 teens for a while there. I mean, just, you know, again, anecdotally, like when I was kind of at the peak of like Outdoor Retailer and there's a freaking just giant pavilion that seemed like it was entirely stand-up paddle boards. I at that time moved to a little town on Puget Sound, and I definitely had, you know, a fleet of paddle boards in the garage. That was kind of like the thing to do. And for good reason. I mean, it's just, frankly, a lot of times it's just more convenient just to be able to like roll up with your paddle board and toss it in and kind of go paddle around a little bit versus maybe, you know, hauling out the sea kayaks. But kind of reflecting back on it, and I'm not sure where things sit today, but, you know, do you feel like the stand-up paddleboard revolution ultimately good for paddling?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I've been paddling for a quarter of a century, you know what I mean? And yeah. You know what I want to do now is something so simplistic and entertaining as going stand-up paddling. It's just, it's a great activity to take part in. You pull the board off of the roof, you put it on the water, you hop on it, and you go. And there's nothing cooler than cruising around a bay, standing up 5-6 feet, and looking down in clear water and seeing what's going on under you. Or just floating down a river or on a lake on your board. I mean, I've gone days and just taken a nap out on a board in the middle of a lake. You know, like stand-up paddling, just like it's like taking a hard left turn and paddling when you think that you've like done everything or found a certain way to enjoy the sport. It's still actually a small segment of paddling. I think what's huge is the marketing factor, and the growth factor. Like every year it's growing. Stand-up paddleboarding just grows year after year.
And the resort side of it. I can't imagine like the tourism side of it. It's just so much easier probably for folks to have that available in like, you know, you're in like a little seaside town in Mexico. Yeah, we got paddleboards. Like hop out there for an hour. Like great. You know, a lot easier than some of the other stuff.
Oh yeah, definitely. People can just hop on the board, and even if they're not getting it, they can just kind of float on the water and enjoy their time, you know?
But it's an interesting point, like coming out of like the impact of stand-up paddleboarding, how it affects the community, kind of right now from your lens sitting there, working at Paddler Magazine, what is the kind of the ranking of the disciplines like between, you know, canoe, sea kayak, obviously recreation is going to be number one, but stand-up paddleboard, whitewater, like where are people spending their time, you know, on the water, on, you know, personal watercraft like this?
Well, canoes and those recreational kayaks we talked about, those are the two at the top. You know, they're tied around the top amount of people who are getting out on the water paddling. And then stand-up paddling. And another interesting one is kayak fishing. Those are kind of in the middle tier. And then whitewater kayaking and sea kayaking are kind of tied down at the bottom. They're the lowest number of users, and you're actually seeing like currently some decline in the core participation group of those groups. Whereas up at canoeing, up at the four other categories I mentioned, like those continue to grow.
Is that affecting brands? I mean, in terms of like, are you seeing fewer boats being made for like sea kayaks and whitewater kayaks and things like that, or is it not really getting to that point yet?
If a whitewater brand or a sea kayak brand, like if that's their thing, they're still making those kind of boats. I think what we're seeing more so, or we've continued to see, are crossover type boats that are good on all kinds of moving rivers and aren't necessarily like whitewater focused, or companies even that were, let's say, legacy sea kayak brands, they might be coming out with some more wreck boats, right? Because you want to get people in it. If people are going to go on a wreck boat, you want to figure out a way to get them in a well-built, well-designed wreck boat.
Right.
You know, and like capture that audience.
So pivoting to what you do, so like, you know, other adventure sports, I feel like paddling had a pretty, I described it as a deep bench when it comes to your media coverage that I recall from like, again, going to like Outdoor Retailer and shows, and you'd see all the different, you know, magazines from the different, you know, different categories of all the sports, and paddling definitely had its fair share represented there. I have to imagine that's changed like everything else has, you know, like between what Outside's doing with their thing and just this sort of the decline of print, and now print sort of coming back and it's in a different form. I mean, what has your experience been at Paddling Magazine as when it comes to the media coverage of the category?
So I've been at Paddling Magazine for 2 years now. This is my second year at Paddling Magazine as a staff editor. And we're pushing into a growth of like making sure that we're connecting with the paddling community. You know, we want to make sure that we are representing the authentic paddling audience. There are not a lot of print magazines for paddle sports left. We have our magazine, Paddling Magazine, and we also, there's another one, a Kayak Session, are the two that are, it's a whitewater focused magazine, and those are kind of the two big ones in North America. Canoe and Kayak used to be a great magazine. I wrote for them for a long time. I started writing for them back in 2014. I had some great editors there who I still get to work with to this day. And they were bought by the company that now owns Men's Journal. So they're under that umbrella of like lifestyle brands. I think Powder might be another one that they own. And maybe Surfer was another one. So that's where Canoe and Kayak went. But there are other great media entities out there. For instance, Northwest River Supply, NRS. If you're a river runner, you know about NRS. They have kind of taken on this role that you see like Patagonia or REI fill with their film documentary type work and their writing work. So it's a pretty core group of media groups in the paddling realm. But I think the sport is well represented for the media footprint that we have. It would be awesome to see a larger media footprint in paddling, and I think the potential is there.
I think the big wild card, Stephen Reginald was on from Gear Junkie a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about, you know, the rise of user-generated content. And it's funny he mentioned that, and it's sometimes, you know, things are right in front of you, you don't connect the dots. And it kind of occurred to me, like, that's a really good point. Like, if I'm going to go do something now, I don't Google it, right, or go to maybe an existing media company. I go to YouTube, right? Let's go. Oh, I'm going to go ride this trail, or I want to go. Where's the put in for, you know, I'm going to go for a boat trip or a surf trip or whatever. Somebody probably made a video about this, you know, or you kind of go looking for things on your own. Do you see that as sort of a positive, a negative? Is that ultimately going to be a good thing? Or is that really kind of leading to the demise of, you know, some of the titles that you were just talking about?
Oh, I think it's one of those two sides of the coin deal.
Yeah.
POV, like, you know, GoPros became a huge part of the user-generated content landscape for paddling. YouTube videos are all over the place about kayaking, running rivers, stuff like that. I would say in a lot of ways, if there's a negative aspect to this, it's that POV killed the kayak film. You know, the idea of that, like, skateboard-style cut movie. I remember, you know, when I was 19 or so, we would lug in these cameras, you know, to film, set up our shots and whatnot. And like, that's not a thing anymore. Like, somebody slaps a GoPro on their head and they put like a half an hour of uncut footage up on YouTube. And so there's that aspect to it. The other aspect that kind of ties into that is it makes it difficult as an editor to encourage voices to come and write for you, right? Like, if somebody can put out their own work, have a YouTube channel, have a newsletter, a website, an Instagram, you want as an editor to get these great voices to contribute to a legacy media company like ours. And we have fantastic columnists, but we're always looking for, you know, new voices to add to the mix. But the flip side, the good side to the user-generated content, number one, going back to that YouTube element and the uncut footage, I actually dive into that stuff as a reporter. When you're trying to like figure out what is going on, what happened out there, what a great resource it is to have this user-generated content. Same thing when I'm watching like boat reviews and stuff like that, it's like, okay, I've got this kayak to review, or I've got this place to go check out. How do I get my base reporting and figure out where to start? Well, I look for what's out there, right? So when you have somebody making a YouTube video about a boat, it kind of gives you a great baseline on where to start, like what's already been covered, or, oh, that's a good question. Let me like dive into that some more. But the reporting element is huge. The other aspect I would say is when we're in like these, our little media bubbles, I see the world from my perspective, right? The perspective that I've built over a couple of decades. But when you watch user-generated content and you're paying attention and reading between the lines, you can really hit into some like subcategories and just like questions, types of things that you wouldn't have even thought of, the way people are interacting with things. So I think that's a really interesting element. You know, when you watch reels, you know, on TikTok or Instagram or on YouTube or reading somebody's newsletter, you just get keyed into these like different elements that you wouldn't have otherwise. So it's that part of it's great.
Kind of the last thing I want to talk about is definitely on the gear front. Like I mentioned at the beginning, I've always been an affinity for the way, you know, the look of the whitewater kayaking. And I feel like, I think paddling just has some of the best stuff when it comes to gear. One of my all-time favorite gear purchases was my used Neki Luxia 4. I don't even know if Neki exists anymore. Does Neki exist? Is Neki still kicking?
Oh, man, I don't think so. I know the Luxia, I believe, is Old Town has it, I believe. So that design still exists. Yeah.
That was a great boat. I got it used in 2001. I loved that boat. I was, you know, up in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and it was out sea kayaking every weekend. Loved that boat. But so looking around, though, at the current landscape of paddling gear, I mean, tons of stuff, right, between the stand-up paddleboards you're talking about, pack rafts, you know, kind of having their moment, and then obviously kayaks, canoes. Like, what stands out to you today when it comes to, and not just on boats, but, like, accessories, things like that? Where does your passion lie with the gear and paddling these days?
Man, the biggest thing from an observational point of view are these boats that are being designed for packability. You mentioned pack rafts. That's a huge one. And once again, like you can go paddle a whitewater river class 3, class 4. Now they're even making pack rafts that can run waterfalls. And it all rolls up into something like this, basically the size of a Nalgene or a camp mat, right? And then you have...
That small?
A pack raft, like from Alpaca or whatnot?
Yeah, but like rolls up that small? Like
maybe
a Nalgene?
Maybe not a Nalgene. That might be an exaggeration. Small. But we'll grab one.
But I'm still, just, that's... Okay, I get your point.
But the point being that it's something, you know, that size
like a small
frame of
bag,
mind.
You know,
yes,
right?
Yeah, 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 small yeah, sleeping yeah. bag versus, say, like a 17-foot fiberglass boat that you have to figure out where
right.
to keep. So,
yeah, you'd be super delicate with unless it's in the water, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Same thing with Oru kayaks. Have you heard about the origami folding kayaks, right? So folding kayaks have been around forever. It's from a recreational standpoint, as long as people have been doing, like selling commercial kayaks, folding kayaks have been around. There was this company, Klepper, over in Europe that started sending boats to the States and stuff like that. But like we look at these Oru origami kayaks that ended up on the cover of National Geographic and the reinvention of the folding kayak. And now we're seeing brands create like more and more high performance folding boats. So that's neat. And when you look at all these different packability elements, it fits the modern lifestyle, right? Whether you have a fuel efficient vehicle, you know, because you're trying to be environmentally conscious, or you live out of your vehicle, like your van, and you need a place to roll something up and store it, or you just have an apartment. Like it goes back to the idea of like the water is right there. You live in a city or any town. I mean, the water is there, but what do I do with this thing? Like, I don't want to have this massive boat that I have to figure out where to keep. So I think the technology in the sense of gear, as we keep moving towards this like packability aspect, we're going to see cooler things come out of that. And it just opens up like a whole demo. It has opened up a whole demographic of people. I've seen we had a story run about folding kayaks with somebody had their Oru kayak on the public transit with them in Queens, you know? So like you can take them anywhere. You could bring them on a bus or a subway.
That's
or
so
whatnot.
Cool.
The other interesting thing I'm just noticing at least coming out of gear right now is the way composites are being marketed. You know, I had always looked at like a carbon boat as this high performance, you know, vehicle, you know, this rigid, strong, light material, like complete power transfer when you paddle a carbon boat. But now what I'm seeing are canoes and touring kayaks that the focus from a marketing perspective is that they're light and easy to transport. And when you see like, the sea kayaking demographic is shrinking, and it's an older demographic. Like, you know, like the most people in sea kayaking are people from a generation or two before me. And
thank you. You're right, though. I can't argue with you.
But so it's interesting because I'm hearing them say like, here's this sea kayak that's light and easy to carry, so you don't have to stop sea kayaking. You could put it on a cart. You can get it onto the car. It's not an issue. And I just thought like, wow, it's like the idea of looking at a full suspension mountain bike versus like a rigid or hardtail mountain bike, right? It's like it's not just because the full suspension is like a higher performance like vehicle that's going to take you through a rock garden and down steep drops. It's also because as you know, your knees start to hurt and stuff like that, it absorbs the impact. It makes it easier to keep getting out there. Right. So we're seeing kind of the same movement with composites now. It's like, hey, you can keep going if you buy this carbon boat versus, you know, that fiberglass boat that weighs almost twice as much.
Right on, man. We can wrap it up there. Anything going on over at Paddling Magazine? You want anything coming out in the next couple of months that you want to make sure people know about?
Our latest issue is at the printer right now, so it'll be mailing out soon, and people can grab a copy at their retailers' bookshops.
Or subscribe.
Yeah, absolutely. Subscribe. PaddlingMag.com.
I will link that in the show notes, man. But Joe, thank you so much for coming on. You're now officially the paddling correspondent for the Rock Fight. Really appreciate you having you here.
Awesome. Thanks, Colin. It was a blast.
All right, that's the show for today. But before you leave us, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening, and then head to rockfight.co and sign up to receive News from the Front, the official newsletter of The Rock Fight. The Rock Fight is a production of Rock Fight LLC. I'm Colin True. Thanks for listening, and here to take us out. The other day, this girl came up to him and asked if she used to go to school with him, and he just kind of laughed. It's Krista Makes with the Rock Fight Fight song. We'll see you next time, Rock Fighters. Rock Fight!